Hello everyone and welcome to our podcast. Today we will be discussing a topic that often comes up in cross-border private equity deals. As we know well, investment agreements are carefully negotiated to ensure each of the parties secure their rights. These agreements also tend to define the obligations of the parties if any disputes arise subsequently. While this is clear with respect to the actual parties of these agreements, we will also explore the role of persons who are not signatories but may still be playing an important role in this entire process. Anirudh, welcome to the podcast. Could you start off by telling those of us who do not have a background in private equity deals how these investment agreements typically work and what the role of affiliates of the signatory parties are?
Thanks, Puru. Investment agreements are typically those agreements by which the investors subscribe or acquire shares in the company. These include share subscription agreement, share purchase agreement, shareholders agreement, or asset purchase agreement, or even a business transfer agreement. At a broad level, the key parties to these agreements can be classified into two buckets. The first one being the entity which pumps in money and receives the shares. The second one being the entity which receives the money. And this second entity can either be the company itself or a selling shareholding entity. Typically, the incoming purchaser would expect certain fundamental warranties in relation to the title of the securities from the exiting shareholding entity. Or we have also seen scenarios where certain business warranties are negotiated between the exiting shareholding entity and the incoming purchaser, but these are commercially negotiated at the deal documentation stage itself.
Thanks, Anirudh, for explaining who the key parties to these agreements are lucidly. Now, we have seen the need for taking comfort from third parties too at the deal documentation stage. Could you throw some light on why this need arises?
Thanks, Puru. That's actually a very good question. Now, let's take an example of a secondary transaction where the selling shareholding entity is selling their shares completely to an incoming purchaser. As mentioned earlier, generally, the exiting shareholding entity provides warranties in relation to the title of the securities and also the authority to execute the said agreements. Say the exiting shareholding entity is a fund or a special purpose vehicle incorporated in Mauritius or any other overseas country. Typically, these funds have a fund life of 8 years and they generally exit these portfolio companies during the 5th or the 6th year. In case there is a defect in the title of shares, the purchaser would like to seek indemnity from the exiting shareholding entity. But in cases where that exiting shareholding entity's fund life has expired and the fund itself is wound up, it kind of becomes tricky to claim indemnity in such scenarios.
So these are some interesting pitfalls that one might think of or one might not think of in the initial stages of negotiating investment agreements. In this example of an indemnity claim arising against an exiting shareholding entity, if the entity has actually wound up the fund, how would deal lawyers such as you ensure that there are proper safeguards in place to address these issues and make sure the buyer is protected?
That's actually a very interesting question, Puru. Thanks for asking it. So we typically include clawback provisions to seek indemnity from the limited partners of the fund or SPV. So a clawback typically means that the purchaser can claim indemnity from the limited partners of the fund, as the fund would have distributed the capital to its LPs at the time of binding up of the fund itself. In order to ensure the successful implementation of this clawback regime, the said clawback obligations would also need to be captured in the fund documents. And these fund documents are those documents through which these limited partners would have invested money in the fund itself so that the funds can invest or deploy that capital further into the portfolio companies. Alternatively, there is also a provision of taking a warranty and indemnity insurance by the parties to the agreements as well.
Thanks, Anirudh. This goes on to further emphasize the importance of carefully negotiating these investment agreements and also the need of having provisions such as clawback provisions or even having the seller insure the buyer for warranties and indemnities through third-party providers. But let's say we're in a situation where there are no clawback provisions or provisions mandating any W&I insurance. Or alternatively, these provisions exist but are inadequate to provide sufficient protection to the buyer. Nishant, could you help us understand this? would the buyer be left without any remedies in this case?
Guru, I don't think it would be accurate to say that there would be no remedies whatsoever. If a dispute arises, and Anirudh spoke of some of the types of disputes that may arise and the need for going after a non-signatory entity. Now, there could be other reasons as well. And one of the most common reasons that we see is that the signatory is more of a paper entity, where even if you do start a dispute, you would not be able to recover certain funds. Now, several legal theories have developed over the years that allow for a non-signatory to the agreement to be made a party to a dispute, even if the investment agreement contains an arbitration clause. Now, which specific theory would apply would of course depend on the specific facts of the case. But let's take the example of the group of companies doctrine, right? If the signatory is a company that was an SPV or otherwise a company that the buyer cannot effectively prosecute a case against, this theory could potentially be pressed into service. Now, it's also interesting to know that the Indian Supreme Court has recently authoritatively ruled that the group of companies doctrine is actually a part of Indian law and it has an independent existence. Put simply, this theory envisages making a group company of the signatory a party to the arbitration if certain conditions are fulfilled. Now, a court or a tribunal that is looking to apply this group of companies doctrine would cumulatively look at a few factors. These include the mutual intent of the parties. Now, what the relationship of this non-signatory is to the signatory who assigned the agreement, whether the transaction was of a composite nature, and the general performance of the contract. Now, without getting into too much specifics, right? If these factors can be shown by the buyer wanting to make a non-signatory a party to the dispute or to the arbitration, then there's a good chance that the buyer can proceed against such a non-signatory. But one last thing to be aware of, though, is all of these theories that allow for a non-signatory to be made a party to a dispute or to an arbitration are very jurisdiction specific. Now, for example, the group of companies doctrine that I just spoke of is well recognized in India, but in some other jurisdictions, such as under English law or under Singaporean law, this doctrine is not recognized at all. So parties would of course need to be mindful of what the applicable laws are and how that would play out in the long run while making the agreement.
Thanks, Nishant, and thank you, Anirudh. Both of you gave very good insights. Thanks to our listeners also for tuning into this podcast. And stay tuned for more, and we will see you next time. Thank you.